This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers.
Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Mars Attacks has invaded Fright Rags with a brand new collection of tees and socks based on the 1960s trading cards. Get them before they get you. Coming next Wednesday, June 19th, the official Day of the Dead collection featuring new designs, classic tees, and reprints from past collections. Just don't choke on them. Use code WAVES10 for 10% off. That's WAVES10 for 10% off, and that's over at fright-rags.com. FRIGHT-RAGS.com.
And Graveyard Slaughter would like to tell you about their upcoming Kickstarter campaign. If you're old enough, you remember the joy of wandering the blissfully bloody aisles of the horror section of your local video store. Not those big, brightly lit stores of Blockbuster either. The hole-in-the-wall shops, that's what I'm talking about. The shops where you could find some deep-dive horror movies. Well, welcome to Video Hell. Lunchbox Press proudly invites you back to those video stores of old and presents Graveyard Slaughter, currently on Kickstarter. Graveyard Slaughter is a comic book anthology that is dripping with sloppy, ooey-gooey 80s VHS gore. Over 50 terrifying pages of madness co-written by New York Times bestselling author Cullen Bunn and Kevin Watkins. Art provided by legendary ghostwriter artist Javier Salteres, rising star Pumpkinhead artist Blackie Shepherd, Gary Bedell, and Adam McLaughlin. Introduction provided by Bram Stoker award-winning and best-selling author Paul Tremblay. Hey, a friend. Graveyard Slaughter will be running on Kickstarter all through June. Graveyard Slaughter will be running on Kickstarter all through June. Back the comic book today to unlock all the super rad stretch goals exclusives only to Graveyard Slaughter Kickstarter backers. Lunchbox Press proudly presents Graveyard Slaughter on Kickstarter this month. And remember to always be kind, rewind, or die. Just head to Kickstarter.com and search for Graveyard Slaughter today.
All right, and welcome to episode 149 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo, sitting here with my main man, Elric Kane. Why are you saying no?
I am saying
no. You're nodding
no. I'm just, you know, it's life, man.
Got your coffee?
I got some coffee with, what is this, knuckle dusters? That's pretty
your
freaking
mug's
badass.
Got a knuckle, brass knuckle thing on it.
I love it, though.
Ryan Turek is here as well.
I'm not your main man.
You are a main man as well.
What the fuck is going on around
I'm
here?
I'm just sitting Jesus.
Left. It just happened to be directly next to me. That's the only reason.
That's fine.
Are you okay?
I'm all right. Good.
He's
all
right. Really upset main dude. About this whole main thing.
Not here. Our main woman is not here. Rebecca McKendry.
She's in New York.
On vacation, right? In New York.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. I think she's
Follow her on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
Yeah.
Many updates.
You can see her anchovy pizza.
Yeah. Who eats anchovies?
Oh, no,
pizza?
I do.
You do?
No, so that's
really?
The one thing would really bond over is I think that is the greatest
the
thing.
The one thing you have in common
that's
is
the
anchovies
one thing.
On
we found
pizza?
One thing. And a movie I watched this week that she also had watched.
Really?
And I only watched it because
Jamie
she was
the
watching
T-Rex?
It. And I, no, well, that
oh,
was
no, that's
wild.
Another one.
No, but this was, she was watching it. And I was like, I couldn't find anything on. I saw that she posted about it. I was like, okay, I'll try this particularly Amityville film. One particular.
Ooh,
and
oh,
then
I
suddenly I was like, oh, yeah, this is great.
Yeah, she texted me and asked me if I'd seen it. And I was like, I own all of them, including the Patty Duke Part 4. It was like a TV movie or something.
Yeah, the hard part is it feels like they're on alternate timelines, so I'm never sure which timeline is
sure.
in the series.
Doesn't matter. Yeah, they're anyway. They're all in the same Amityville universe.
We'll get to it.
So here we are. What's new and exciting, guys?
I finally caught up to you guys. I went to the Graham Skipper's latest rated R bar because I didn't make it the first time. I think I was out of town. It is phenomenal.
It's a lot of
fun.
It was
like 2 weeks ago. Yeah. It was just super fun. But I will say this, I thought we felt like big deals in Texas. I didn't walk 2 feet without somebody coming up to me saying, oh, I love your podcast. Of both podcasts. It was
oh, wow.
really kind of cool because you realize, oh, well, this is the kind of people where you make this stuff for, yeah. for one. But also it was super fun. Each room had like a totally different theme. You had art on display. You had like amazing, I think, I'm trying to think who it was who designed the, each wall had a piece of like, whether it's the Blob playing or Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, yeah, that was a new addition. I wasn't able to go this time, but I did see a lot of social media posts and it looked like they had projections on the wall.
It was all montage of that. There was like video games. I got to, you know, I think I played a Deranged Simpsons game and it was just cool and had a great drink. I don't know. It's just, if this becomes a regular, like once a month thing or whatever, I am all for it.
Yeah. And I think it is. Well done, Graham. I think that's the plan at least.
Yeah. So I highly encourage it. And I think it might be touring or some variation of that. Maybe I'm wrong. I thought I saw a photo of Graham in like Chicago saying, here we come, it's an apocalypse or something. Oh, wow. Okay. We'll see. But either way, super cool. And it's just so cool that, you know, with Slashback and all these kind of things that people keep doing, if you had enough of them running throughout the year, it'd be like every weekend there'd be something badass to do. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. It's kind of great for the horror community. So that was a good time.
Rob, you want to talk about Swamp Thing?
Yeah, let's talk about that. So I've already had DC, the app, for a little bit because I watched Titans. Yeah. I'm way behind, but I saw an episode of Doom Patrol and loved it.
Yeah.
And you signed up specifically because Swamp Thing was coming?
Specifically for Swamp Thing. And then I fell in love with Doom Patrol.
Yeah.
So we got about five episodes into Doom Patrol, which any genre fan should check out because it's incredibly kooky and dark. And Brendan Fraser is fantastic in it. And the actress that plays Crazy Jane's in it. You know, yeah. I mean, like everybody's just a really great, is giving it their all. And then Swamp Thing debuted episode number one. And I was like, this is going to be fantastic based on Doom Patrol. Doom Patrol and the quality and the performances had already paved the way for the quality that I was going to get on this DC app.
Yeah.
And I was really happy with the investment. And then, so we watched Swamp Thing and I thought it was fantastic. I mean, like James Wan, as you guys know, produced it. Len Wiseman, directed it.
Oh, he's I didn't realize that.
Yeah. From the director. Underworld director.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just, it takes you into the thick of the swamp and it's, you could feel the atmosphere and the production and, you know, the production design's beautiful. And, you know, you've got actors like Will Patton and Crystal, what's her name? Crystal Reed.
Yeah. Yeah. That was so funny. Crystal Reed, who was on Teen Wolf for a big chunk of time.
Is that her thing? That's where she came from?
Yeah. Teen Wolf was a big one. I think there was another big show too, but I remember distinctly her first movie was Skyline. Which is, I don't know, 10 years ago.
She's in Skyline?
I met her because of you, because you sent me for Shock T Drop, and I was her first ever interview. I literally remember, like,
you're welcome.
Walking. Yeah, I was. we went to the side, you know, while they were in between shooting, like, on the staircase, and that's I was interviewing the cast, and she's like, hey, this is my first interview I've ever done with anybody. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's so cool. And actually, I remember the scoop we got out of that was she said, I signed to do this show called Teen Wolf, and your quote was, she's the boof of the show, which wasn't accurate. At the hall, but that's what we ran with. I was like, hey, she's a girl.
Was she the brunette or the redhead?
She's a brunette.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But anyway, the whole point being is, you know, here's somebody that's had this great career over the course of the last 10 years, and she's the lead on Swamp Thing. And I immediately just flash back to like, wow, that was like a blink of an eye where 10 years ago she was this shy, you know, oh, this is my first movie and this is my first interview I've ever done. I'm like, man, and look at her now.
Yeah.
Is she's great on the show. And Swamp Thing, one of the storylines they actually covered in the books? Or
unknown. I mean, I dipped in and out of the Alan Moore.
Yeah, the Moore stuff is what I've been reading for the last like, couple months.
I think that's, I mean, I'm not as well versed in the comic books to know, but it definitely feels like it's probably from that Moore verse because here's the thing. Show's terrific. The origin is similar to it, but it's much more creature feature. It's much more intended to be scary.
It's almost like the Thing-esque in
there
nature.
Is a lot of Thing in Swamp Thing. Like a lot. Like basically
body
that's what
horror.
It is body horror and these creatures and stuff. There's actually a very blatant Thing homage with a head doing a thing.
Oh, yeah.
But it's funny because you start watching it and you see this gag start to happen and it's whatever, CG, whatever, but like good CG. And it's only like, you know, 5 seconds in, you're like, oh, I guess that's where their budget runs out. And it goes rampant and like, you know, and it's like, wow.
And Derek Mears is Swamp Thing.
Oh, yeah.
He looks cool. So good. They nailed the look of Swamp Thing. And I always liked the movie Swamp Thing. I like Wes Craven's, but I also loved
that's such a different kind of
Wynorski's.
Wynorski's is more fun.
Very, 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 very different. But Wynorski kind of got Swamp Thing right.
Yeah.
Like, I love the design of that, and
cool.
I really gravitated to that. But
do they see him in human form?
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah.
The first
he's Alec.
The pilot.
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
The pilot is Alec. It's not Derek who plays Alec.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. Right. Yeah, okay.
But yeah, once he becomes Swamp Thing, all of a sudden, you know.
And they give him enough time for us to, you know, be charmed by him. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a really cool cat. He's kind of he thinks outside the box as a scientist. One of the running gags is like he's always wearing sandals, and she's always busting his balls about that. But
he's actually playing Eddie in It Chapter 2. Not Eddie. Stan.
Stan,
He's the adult version of Stan.
That's right.
I looked it up. Yeah. I was like, who is this guy? Because he is really, I didn't recognize him. Like, he's kind of charming. I've never even heard of this guy. And that's his other credit.
Wait, so this all sounds great. So what could go wrong?
Well, what went wrong is...
Do you have any insight?
Live news feed.
Well, what went wrong after episode one is they decided to can the show.
That seems like a weird timing to announce that when people are still going to be signing up to your app.
Absolutely baffling.
Yeah,
absolutely baffling. I mean, like, I don't know if that is sufficient enough time to gather information that you need, like, based on an episode one.
Like, the fact that you're only getting to talk about Swamp Thing this week.
Oh, yeah.
It's not canceled and not, like, they're still going to air all 10 episodes.
They're still running all 10 episodes, but there will be no future seasons of it, which sucks.
But that kills people who would sign up. Like, I might not sign up because of that.
I read articles.
I hate that feeling.
I read comments under Deadline. They were like, well, I guess that's that. I'm going to cancel my DC app. Yeah. And I'm like, well, that is not supporting the people who need you to support the show. It'll pop up somewhere else. I mean, like, season one, they'll probably release the Blu-ray and Warner Brothers will handle all that shit.
Yeah, it'll probably be Netflix overseas because that's what Titans is.
But the thing is that we're living in a day and age where every major company is going to have their own app and you're going to have to subscribe to it. Cable's going to get phased out. You know, Universal will have one. Warner Brothers will have one. Sony will have one. Everybody's going to have one of these things. So, you know, all of the entities that live under these giant banners are going to just get folded into that. Yeah. So from what I'm reading, it made no sense for DC to have its own app, considering that Warner Brothers, who owns DC, is just going to create their own thing, and they're going to have to carry over all that stuff anyway. Because if you go to the DC app, this is the great thing. Before I lose my subscription to it, I mean, obviously we've got a couple weeks, 10 weeks. I want to go through all the Batman animated series.
Yeah.
Those look fantastic.
Also, access to every comic book they've ever done.
I'll
show you what it looks like, because you can literally, it goes panel by panel.
Yeah.
But you can literally pick any one of their comic books.
It's super wild. Yeah. But the great thing is like all of them are, all the Batman animated series are in HD. I watched the first episode, the Man Bat episode, and I completely fell in love with that show all over again. But look at that. That's all the comics. Well, Rob is right now showing Elric.
Literally, just for our listeners. It will zoom into, it's not doing it now.
I think you got to double click.
I can see on a Kindle an iPad, how that could actually feel right.
Yeah, I was doing a little bit of that, but
that's crazy.
But it's a bummer, man. I watched episode two of Swamp Thing.
That's a panel right there.
Yeah.
But is there a good reason? Like, I mean, I know there's lots of theories why this happened online and people talk, but is there anything that you can think of that could make sense?
It was expensive.
Okay.
It's a very expensive show, and it looks like the sign-ups.
I don't know. I mean, like, all the money is there on the page. Mm-hmm. I mean, up on the screen. Mm-hmm. It looks great. In episode two, it loses a little momentum because they're filling in a little bit of backstory and paving some dramatic runway. But Swamp Thing comes back in like the latter half, and it's like, fuck, man, I can't wait to see this guy speak. And apparently he speaks in episode three. But man, Swamp Thing is the kind of cool comic horror show that we've been waiting for, and
it sucks that
RIP.
That and Hellblazer had the same issues. And that's a great storyline. If you ever read the Garth Ennis one, right? It was Hellblazer and Swamp Thing interconnected, and you're like, who wouldn't want to see this shit?
Well, they did the animated film Justice League Dark, which has them both in it.
You told me about that.
But you know, it's funny because I actually saw Facebook. Well, yeah, basically James Wan and Neil Marshall having a conversation publicly about it, because James is saying, hey, I don't know why these decisions happen, why these things get canceled. And Neil's like, hey, try doing a pilot and creating a show that gets canceled. And then they take your character and the actor and put him in every other DC show continually. And it's like, why didn't you just keep Constantine going? Instead, he's in every other DC show now.
Yeah. So strange.
So who knows? So maybe Swamp Thing will pop up in one of the other things at this point.
Maybe. Who knows? But Doom Patrol is fantastic as well. Well, and that one is, whether they get renewed is unknown at this moment. So, but they renewed Titans apparently.
Hmm.
Well, I'll fill you on another show then, if we're doing shows first. NOS 4A2, which is on AMC, which is, you know, clever. This is a Joe Hill creation. Was this an original Joe Hill thing, or is this based on a book?
Okay. Oh, no, it's a book.
It is based on a book. Okay. Yeah. So I didn't know the book, didn't know anything about it. Just watched them both maybe two nights ago. It has, what's the actor from Star Trek and
Zach Quinto
playing this creepy, at the start, he's like 100-year-old looking chauffeur of this amazing Wraith limo that pulls up outside kids' houses who's got abusive parents, or parents who aren't, or not even that abusive, just parents who are like dismissive of the kid. And he tells them, why don't you come to Christmas Land, where all kids are always happy? And the kids are like, oh, I want to go to Christmas Land. Who doesn't? And it's like, yeah, where kids are always, it's Christmas every day there. That's the pitch. So he'll tell these kids. So it opens with an abduction where he's taking this kid to Christmas Land, but he doesn't hurt the kids on the thing. On the drive, on the long drive to Christmas Land, what you start noticing is he starts getting younger and the kid starts turning vampiric and older.
The kids start sleeping.
Yes, they start having teeth and looking like kind of like Nosferatu. And so that's kind of part of the horror of, say, the first episode, and the bad things happen to the parents. It hasn't shown it to reveal its cards to like what the greater story is. But while that's happening, there's a couple young teenagers in the town who have certain kinds of powers. So obviously there's going to be some people who might have the ability to stand up against this dark entity that's entered town. This one girl can, on her motorbike, because she's struggling with her home life, and she has all these like anger, and she kind of channels her blind anger. She's driving through the woods, and suddenly like a bridge, like from Bridges of Madison County, one of those old covered bridges, appears and hasn't been there in 20 years. She drives through it. When she drives through it, when she gets to the other side, anything she was thinking about, so in the case, like her father lost his watch, and it caused a fight at home, she gets to the other side and finds the watch at the place it is, and then comes back. So she's able to channel, I need to get this thing. She can get, so it would make sense that she might be, in the long run, being able to get the kids who are missing or something.
Such a weird ability.
It's weird. But the setup is, it's swinging big, which I like. But I will say, my pitch to people, I don't know if this is going to be great or not yet. I really can't tell from two episodes, but I found it very watchable. But it definitely fills the Channel Zero hole, because it feels very similar to the tone and style of the Rutger Hauer series. Not what it hasn't got cannibals, but just like the idea of a path in the middle of the forest, kids missing, and just, it's shot really well. It's got AMC production value. So far so good. I'd be, you know, probably five episodes in, we'll have a better idea if it's going to hold up. They spend a lot of time on character stuff. So, you know, it feels like they're laying good groundwork, but I don't know. I'm kind of into it. I'm kind of enjoying, I love not knowing what it's going to be yet. Like two episodes in, it's like, I don't know how this is he just trying to abduct a lot of kids? What's he going to do with them? Are they going to be an army of vampires? I have no idea. And you don't see like teeth on him yet, so it's not like clear he's a vampire, but clearly he's now young Zachary, you know, by episode two, so he's clearly draining victims somehow. But
that's cool.
But it's kind of cool. So that one's on AMC, and from what I understand, if you have, again, the app, you can watch the entire series at once, whereas if you have cable, it's a once a week kind of show. So yeah, I'm kind of into it.
Cool. Rob?
Cool. Yeah, I have a couple things that I just picked up. One, here's a movie I've always wanted to see, never saw, and then I think it's Mill Creek put out a super cheap Blu-ray, and it's The Eyes of Laura Mars.
Oh, yeah.
Which is from 1978, Carpenter, written by John Carpenter, but not directed by John. Yeah. It's directed by Irvin Kershner, the director of The Empire Strikes Back, of all things. And it stars Faye Dunaway and Tommy Lee Jones, and it is a really cool, interesting, well put together little thriller. And I like it because it's kind of in that early Carpenter vein where he was doing, what's the other one? Someone is with Laura Hutton. Someone's watching me.
I get the two mixed up.
So it's right in that time period where it's like that, like right, basically right before Halloween.
Yeah.
Where he was doing these like kind of top thrillers. And it's pretty cool. I mean, basically Faye Dunaway is a well-known photographer that's got a exhibit and a book out. And I think it's actually called The Eyes of Laura Mars, where she focuses on just the portraits and the eyes of these models in particular and in violent situations. And there's a serial killer out there that is targeting the very people in her life that are involved in the book and killing them. And every time it happens, she has a weird, like, I don't know if they ever even explain it. She has like almost like a psychic flash. Like she sees it happening as it happens.
Yeah. She's seeing through the eyes of the killer.
Yeah, exactly. And so she's completely terrified and doesn't know what to do. And Tommy Lee Jones is kind of like, he's a detective who's kind of like investigating the whole thing. And even at first, he's a little standoffish with her, being like, do you think it's appropriate to have violent content? Like, don't you think this inspires violent content? Which is probably John's like own two cents about movies versus reality and all that stuff. But it's a really cool little movie. And again, it's like, this just dropped on Blu-ray out of nowhere from Mill Creek. It's like $9 on Amazon, which is ridiculously cheap. And again, it's like, if you do a deep dive into Carpenter's filmography, I think this totally counts in the same way that, you know, I consider like True Romance a Tarantino movie, even though it's Tony Scott,
right?
It's still got his voice. This definitely has got that Carpenter voice to it. And it's always fun to see Tommy Lee, like young Tommy Lee Jones, had that weird charm to him. Like, I can't explain it. He just looks like a gruff, kind of good looking dude from that period that you're like,
but born an old man. Inside, he's already an old man. Now, I remember this having some pretty cool flash, like in terms of the visuals. What's the Catherine Bigelow 1999 movie again, where it's also where you're
Strange
watching
Days.
Yeah, Strange Days. When you're watching through the eyes of the killer, I feel like that was taking something from this movie in terms of just the device.
Yeah. When you and Brian were doing your Carpenter retrospective on Pure Cinema, did you guys do this one or you skipped over?
We didn't do anything he wrote. Only directed, because otherwise you just for detours. But yeah, I think it might have been mentioned. I haven't seen it since like, you know, 10-15 years, and I remember liking it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's difficult to get, but now that this Blu-ray is very easily readily available,
yeah,
and it's just cool to have it out there again.
Nice.
Yeah, so Eyes of Laura Mars.
Have you two seen all of Chernobyl?
None of it.
No, not yet.
Jesus,
I just got access to HBO Go.
It's been a rough couple weeks. I don't think I could have handled Chernobyl on top of my life right now.
It's excellent. It is probably
one of my favorite.
Chernobyl.
Jared Harris, right?
Jared Harris. Yeah, it's probably one of my favorite things this year so far. And and it's interesting because it was so unassuming going in.
Yeah.
You were like, oh, HBO is doing a 5-part series about Chernobyl, the Chernobyl incident. And I talked a little bit about this last time, but I finally finished all the episodes. And it's such a show that's just dripping with so much dread and frustration and anxiety, and it's doing so. It's just a beautiful, like, it's a perfect symmetry of just music and visuals sometimes.
Oh, cool.
Where
I avoided it because I just assumed it's a talky drama.
No.
So if it's not that,
definitely not. Because the beauty of the show, or the terrifying thing of the show, is you've got Jared Harris kind of leading this charge of cleanup efforts. That took months, like months upon months. And you had no idea that, I mean, like even when I was a kid growing up and I heard about Chernobyl, I thought it was a singular incident. I was just like, okay, cool. They contained it. It's done. No, like December of that year, it was still an issue and it was still going on. But, you know, Jared Harris's character and all those who are in the area are being affected by the radiation. So they're talking about, you know, their cleanup efforts and they're talking about their lives, but they all know they have an expiration date now. Like, and it's probably in the immediate or somewhat near future, at least 5 years time. And that is just,
that's bleak.
It is incredibly bleak.
What's funny, I got a taste of, like this week, 2 days ago, I had to clean, I found black mold in a bathroom that had to be thing. So to save like $1,000, I had to buy like one of those suits I'd gone in there without anything. And then people freaked out at me. They're like, if you're around mold, that gets airborne and you can actually get really sick. So here I am cleaning and scrubbing black mold wearing a full hazmat suit, right? Yeah. Sweating like fuck. And actually the whole time your heart's beating kind of fast because you don't know if you're doing it right. You don't know if you're getting, so I'm thinking, imagine that. That's just mold. Yeah. So now imagine, you know, it's nuclear radioactivity. How scary that must be. It's like, wild.
Yeah, it's insane. But it's a fantastic show. Apparently, it's one of HBO's biggest hits, which is so interesting.
Such a serious topic.
Yeah, But really fantastic.
Yeah, I was just nervous because I feel like it's like Threads territory.
I know, Threads is so
well, that's the thing. I saw a lot of people. I saw a lot of people talking about Threads. Threads is a completely different thing to me in a way.
But that's about scaring you out of, well, not wanting that event to happen. It's not about the after effect a bit, but Threads is incredible though. Like Threads is one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen, like to just shock you into what that could do.
Yeah.
So maybe they're, you know, good pairings. I'll take it down a notch then.
Please, yeah.
Silliness. Phoenix Fan Fusion, my favorite thing about any convention, and I'm always disappointed when they don't have this, is the bootleg table. Yeah. It's the first thing I look for. I'd rather buy a couple bootleg. And when I say bootlegs, they're things that aren't available. So these guys only tend to put things for that are stuck on VHS onto discs. So I got a couple things. One is my favorite thing ever, and the other one is not. I would say the first one, I brought a copy for Ryan. When there's no more slashes left in or hell, this will walk the earth. So this is the last slasher you need to ever watch, but had a great title. It was called The Night Brings Charlie.
Okay. Never heard of this.
It's a tree trimmer.
Oh.
Who is using tree trimming equipment to brutally kill teenagers.
I'm in.
I know. And he's got a big mask. You never really see his face for a long time. He's come back from the war and he's not right. And he's gone back and his name's Charlie. And that's all the story I could really recount. I think it was like 90. So it's like just the, you know, end of the slasher period. It's got a really cool cover. I've got the bootleg here.
Oh, let me see.
It's definitely from VHS. He's disfigured from the war. Tree surgeon becomes a prime suspect. There's a couple twists in it. It has a bit of a feeling of the SOVs. I don't think it's shot on video, but it has a bit of that feel. But there's a couple gruesome murders in it. It had a real mixed rating. Because now what I do is when I go to this thing, if it's titles I don't know, I quickly go on Letterboxd. And if it's all 2 stars or 1 star, I miss it. But if there's a couple people saying, no, it's actually really good, I'll take a chance.
The way they describe him on the back of the box is a disfigured tree surgeon.
Yeah, I know. He's just cutting trees. I mean, he's got nothing to do with being a tree surgeon. Anyway, it's kind of junky, but it was like, I figure for you as a slasher completist, you need this in
your
life.
Thank you so much. So I can't wait to watch this.
And it's a good cover if this was like a VHS.
It's Father's Day this weekend. I'm going to request one thing. Give me 90 minutes to watch this movie.
The Night Brings Charlie.
Take 70 and just fast forward parts. But anytime they're talking, get there. But the good news is, and I think you might have already seen this one.
Okay.
This one was recommended on the Brain Melters, I think, with Brian and Phil Blankenship. I don't remember which one of them was, and I didn't have it. Demon Warp. Just filled the void that Night Beast, now finally being for the masses, has filled in me. I got to say, this is probably the most fun and the most I've laughed out loud this year.
Oh, the George Kennedy movie.
George Kennedy.
1988. Yeah, this
movie
I have a bootleg
is freaking awesome.
Yes.
Okay, the first half is just a Sasquatch attack movie. Within the first minute, a Sasquatch breaks into the house. George Kennedy is playing Trivial Pursuit, and the answer is Lon Chaney Jr. on a question. I'm like, he's just chilling playing Trivial Pursuit.
We had this poster hanging at Slashback.
Oh my God, this movie's so good. Yeah, he's chilling with his daughter playing Trivial Pursuit. he gets the question, which the answer is Lon Chaney Jr. He feels very happy. Suddenly the door kicks in. A giant Yeti-looking Sasquatch monster busts through, assaults his daughter, knocks him out, and then takes off. And then George Kennedy's not in the movie again for like an hour. Then a bunch of dumb teens, very redundant, kind of terrible drama. Teens enter the story.
This was Phil Blankenship. Yeah, it's totally one of his movies.
It's freaking, this is a movie now, if you saw this in the middle, kind of like Night Beast, but this is like a higher production value. If this came on in the middle of an all-nighter, you would wake the fuck up. Like, I was watching this at midnight, and towards the end, my eyes started closing a bit, and then the whole genre would change. The last 20 minutes becomes a totally different, like sci-fi kind of bizarro zombies. I didn't even want to go into it. I know it's going to be hard to find. I have this bootleg. I have to assume maybe YouTube has a good quality version potentially. But it's basically a bunch of people, these teens, after they get attacked. What's cool is they don't hide the Yeti from you. The Yeti actually physically each time enters the house, kills people. You're staring at it. And it's not really a Yeti because the opening scene is a flying saucer dropping down to earth, depositing. So it's probably like an alien hybrid Yeti, and then there's a twist of who it actually kind of is by the end of the movie. This movie is utterly bonkers. I have to assume Vinegar Syndrome is working on this. About it now, it means we're going to get it in
Let's
2 months,
hope.
Just like Night Beast. But this is one of the most fun I've had. So this is when bootlegs totally pay off.
I'm looking at has to be a foreign poster because the other one was VHS box. But the tagline says, somewhere between light and shadow, ancient fear and future shock and the living and the undead.
Well, that's
the
that's a lot
of demon war.
Well, yeah, and he's also collecting, he's breaking in and taking people's radio pieces and stuff. So there's a bit of that feeling of the ET kind of thing where ET was collating all these pieces of a tech. But George Kennedy features heavily on the poster and the advertising, but he's very, very infrequently in it. But it's so cool when you just discover these things that you have never seen. I remember as soon as Phil talked about it, I remember just going, oh shit, I got to see that one day. And this is a great way to see it. But I think, again, trapped on VHS for now.
I think, you know, George Kennedy had a run there. I think we need a George Kennedy all-nighter.
Ghost Ship.
Just his horror movie.
Just Before Death Dawn. Death Ship. Sorry. Just Before Dawn, this.
Demon War.
Yeah, no, he's great. But this movie, when it changes tones, you're not ready for the different tones this movie suddenly gives you about an hour into it. It is, it deserves the title of Brain Melter. So that was my two purchases from the Fan Fusion bootleg world, which was totally worthwhile.
Cool. I got one more for you. I'm only going to moderately talk about it because
I was going to watch it. I got my disc too.
We'll just talk about the movie briefly, but then we could delve into it next week when we've all had a chance to check out the special features. But Blue Underground is just unstoppable now in repurposing some of their older catalog and doing 4K, three disc, limited edition versions. And again, every time I'm like, nah, I don't need to upgrade Maniac or Zombie, then I get them and I'm like, oh my God, this is the definitive version. Well, now they're going to Fulci again for the New York Ripper, which doesn't need to look this good, and yet it does. It is like the most perfect presentation of this sleazy movie where it's a crazed killer who quacks like a duck running through New York City and tearing apart women. Whether it's on the ferry, there's one girl that's like leaving a message for somebody on his car and, she becomes a victim. Then there's a sex worker who's doing a live show and then immediately after gets attacked by the killer.
The movie theater is amazing. Like, it has a reflection in the knife. And it's just got that's the thing about Fulci. You'll have these clunky scenes followed by like something that's so cinematic. Like, holy shit. Like,
there's some gnarly stuff. There's, of course, the eye violence. There's one very particularly nasty kill. He calls and taunts the cop and quacks a lot. And basically kills a girl while he's on the phone. And it's literally like he's got like a razor blade. And basically he goes for the stomach first and you see it, then like half a nipple. And then he goes for the eye and you're like, oh no, not the Fulci eye. And it's never looked sharper than on this 4K like restoration. Not that we needed it. I don't know. I fall like Fulci is such a, I think you quoted it best. Like, there's just so many great moments in not so great movies.
Yeah, his high marks are higher than like Bava's for me, but Bava's obviously a better film director. Well, Bava knows how to put movies together. But there's something about Fulci's. I think it's because he reveals parts of his psychology at times, and it's so interesting. I think what would be most interesting is for Lucio Fulci to be alive now, to see something like that, to see that there's a three disc beautiful restoration of a film where he's probably like making a joke, like with the New York, you know, the quacking.
Yeah.
Do we know why the quacking exists? Have you ever?
Yeah, it ties into it thematically. There's a duck theme.
I'm just wondering if Fulci, like, it just seems like a weird
why he went that is between Fulci
and his god
and his brain
and a cat in his brain.
And I talked about it a while back. It has got to be probably the most mean-spirited
it absolutely is of all time. The whole cafe scene with the woman and the guy.
That's weird too. The toe. Well, I don't know who the main girl is. There is a character that literally is at the movies and like scoping
she's
out
like,
a guy
she's like,
with
she's
no
like
fingers.
Recording her sexual adventures for her husband back at home.
Yes.
Or something like that.
And you assume she's the main character, but then she's out. You're like, oh, what happened to her? Okay.
That's what I like about it. It's like an ensemble. It's like a crazy Fulci ensemble. I agree with you. You know, Fulci is defined by his greatest moments, Splinter to the Eye, you know, stuff like that. But I just have the palate for it. I love it. I love the meal.
I feel like some of them are consistent. I think House by the Cemetery is real consistent as a film. Like, it doesn't feel
consistent in its repetition.
Yeah, but it feels like as a whole movie, it feels consistently one tone, where sometimes he goes, you know,
I don't know, man. This is a weird one. And by the way, the three discs it's the Blu-ray, a DVD of it, and the complete soundtrack, which has been what I really dig that they include the soundtracks at this point. There's some new features. I skimmed through a little bit of it because some of the newer ones, but obviously they're all subtitled and they're lengthy interviews of people. And when it's late at night, you're kind of like, you know what? I'm good for now. And then there's older ones. Like, there is a feature about like New York then and now, but I think it's like from whenever he shot it, 1982 and like 2000. 9. So like several, like 10 years ago. Mm. And you know, New York has the pier hasn't changed as much in those shots or anything, but it's still kind of fun to have all the stuff there. And also I haven't read the comic book yet, but there's a bunch of, it's the guys that do Rotten Cotton have a comic book series for them, for Maniac. And they have done a zombie. Maniac versus New York Ripper, which so cool. I don't know why. I just, Joe Spinell and like a killer wearing a duck mask saying quack, quack on the front cover. I don't know why I need that story, but I do.
Well, that kind of crossover reminds me of how Maniac was meant to be the Maniac cop. So imagine somebody should do a fan fiction where Joe Spinell is the Maniac cop. You know what I mean? The maniac becomes a cop, and he's, because I think that's where the original idea came from. Because Larry Cohen said to Bill, well, you got the Maniac. Why don't you just
do a sequel?
Maniac cop. Like, and it's like the hybrid, and that would be a fucking great thing. Because Spinell is playing a cop in Cruising. Remember? He's in the.
Well, that's where you,
That's where he's got the
poetry. I mean, look, here's a, because I don't think the killer in New York Ripper wears a Donald Duck mask. But he does in the comic book.
Yeah, in my brain he does though.
Like, But I love the idea of Maniac versus, you know, move over Frank. There's a new Maniac in town.
That's pretty
cool. I want quack, this quack, book. Quack.
Yep. Just like Joe Spinell is Maniac. So anyway, the New York Ripper is I mean, if Blue Underground does one or two of these a year, then it is a solid upgrade. This one comes out June 25th. So it should be coming right after this episode airs.
Nice.
Yeah, worth a look.
Cool. Any last one?
That's it for me.
I got one more.
I just want to just reinforce for those who are looking for a good read. I finally finished Haunted Forest Tour, which was that kind of Jurassic Park meets Cabin in the Woods kind of mishmash. It goes into some really wild places. You discover, I told you guys a little bit about this, but it's basically about in the middle of the desert, a forest suddenly sprouts up. It's about 5 miles wide. In radius, and within the forest is a haven for monsters. And I'm not just talking about like monster, like flesh and blood monsters, but also like specters and stuff like that. But they will never leave the radius of the forest. And then this company comes in and creates a railway that goes around the forest and then through the forest. And of course, during the special Halloween tour, which goes through the through the forest, the the train cars break down, and then the monsters run amok. And the whole thing focuses solely on the survivors who need to get out. And this is all in the first, I think last time I talked about it, it was like all in the first like 100 pages. And I was like, what the fuck? I'm like, how much more is there to explore? A lot more, apparently, because you're focusing on these survivors as they try to get out, the people who are outside the forest. And then you discover that there is a very distinct reason as to why the train cars broke down, and maybe someone made a deal with one of the creatures inside. Mm-hmm. But it's a blast, and there's a moment where a dragon shows up and you're just like, of course. So you get like a dragon versus a helicopter and all this other crazy shit, but it's a lot of fun. And usually I feel like some of these books I've been reading lately have kind of just petered out by the last 50 pages, but this is pedal to the metal all the way through, and I had a blast with it. So yeah.
Cool.
The last one is thanks to Becca. So Becca, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, she was watching Amityville, It's About Time, which I believe is 4.
It could be, yes.
Could be 4.
5.
And so I was at the same time at home looking through Prime, being bored, not being able to find anything. So I was like, fuck it, I'm going to watch it at the same time. And I'm glad I did, because I thought I'd seen all these ones, because I definitely have done a pretty deep dive into these ones. It's Amityville 1992, It's About Time.
Oh, and it's Tony Randall directed.
Yeah, so that's the thing, which makes total sense for Becca, because she is a huge Tix and Hellraiser 2 fan. So there you go, Tony Randall.
Well, it works out.
This movie's real bonkers fun. It doesn't make a lick a sense at times as an Amityville. It has some things like with time travel alluded to it that it never goes into. Like,
this is the clock.
So it's basically a dad in where I live, Santa Clarita, because I literally recognized one part of it. He comes home. It looks like Florida that time. He comes home with this clock. He's got this weird relationship with like the nanny, who's his ex, who he's probably going to get back together with, and he's got two teenage kids. And then the clock, when the clock is, he's slowly being possessed. Of course, you're going to find out that the clock came from the Amityville house. That's the only connection. So this is during their haunted props, I guess, sequence.
Yeah, because I have this in a triple feature on a DVD, which is three different Amityville movies. Each one was just something from the house
Are any of the others good? Do you remember? Because this one was actually pretty fun.
Well, she texted me while she was watching this. I confused it with the one that has, there's another one that's pretty decent that's got David Naughton and Terry O'Quinn in it.
What?
Yeah. Let me look that one up really quick.
I know one has yuppies. That's really bad.
Amityville movies are like a plague.
But this one has, many of them. This one has a lot of, because it's Tony Randall, you actually get a lot of interesting practical effects. This weird stuff like bringing people into the floorboards and taking them over. And it's really gory and it's very silly. It actually has a total from total The Beyond moment where a woman and her dog are watching him. And he's like, it's literally like shot like the same scene. And then the dog attacks him. I don't know. It's fun. I think if this is on Amazon Prime, I believe there isn't much more to add to it. It's just like everyone's slowly being possessed. I would say it might be the best one outside of two. I think two is so much fun and so bonkers. This is very close on the bonkers level. And this also has weird brother, sister incest, just like part two. So it's hitting all those great beats. If you love those incest beats, this is the movie for you.
It was right after this was Amityville, A New Generation, nice. Which has got David Naughton, Terry O'Quinn, Lynn Shay.
Damn.
This is the one I thought Becca was talking about, but it's not.
I might watch that one too. Yeah.
This one's not bad from what I remember.
Okay, but yeah, this is if you're looking for.
Oh, this one's a mirror.
This one's
a mirror. Yours was a clock.
Okay,
this is an old mirror.
And I've heard there's a lamp. I know there's a lamp.
And the lamp is probably the third one. All right.
Maybe I'm gonna watch these three. Maybe that's the new goal in life. But anyway, I think Becca liked this one, but we'll hear her report next week. And I thought it was fun. It's a little goofy and silly, but it's. But I will give you one big spoiler. Get ready for it.
I'm here.
The last line of the movie.
I'm here for it.
She just turns and goes, "It's about time," which is the title of the movie. The last, I cut to black.
Are you serious?
Yep, I'm going to give you that. Just because I don't want you shocked when you watch this movie.
Wow.
Any movie that has the title as the last line is, you know, is in the wheelhouse, baby. Good fun. You
amazing.
Know? Yeah. So,
really quick, have either of you seen Vox Lux?
Not yet.
Brady Corbett's movie.
It's pretty cool. I like his stuff.
It's pretty cool. You should check it out. Yeah, we should talk more once you've seen it. Brady Corbett, if you guys don't know, he's an actor.
Great actor. Yeah.
Funny Games remake, but really interesting story. Understand, and you know, these are for those who are sensitive to this. With the way it was sold and the way it was positioned, was like it's Natalie Portman playing a pop star. What I got when I first started watching it was a fucking school shooting movie.
Oh,
and it's heavy.
I thought it was gonna be like a Black Swan.
No,
thing.
I don't want to spoil anything, but it is fucking heavy right from the get go, and you see a lot of Corbett's artistry come into play. But terrific performances, really good stuff from Natalie Portman, and there's a younger actress, and I'm blanking on her name. But she was also in Killing of a Sacred Deer. She was the daughter.
Oh, yeah.
She was amazing in it. But Brady makes some very interesting choices in this. And I definitely, it's not going to be for everybody, but this is definitely my jam. But
what do you, he learned from, what's that director who made Simon Killer and all that? He started with that guy. He acted in a couple films and then he started directing his own. He made Leader of a Childhood. Whatever. But he seems to be, I mean, learning from people like Haneke. He's learning the craft fast.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, no, it is very cool. But yeah, Vox Lux. I think it's on Hulu right now. So
yeah, I think I do want to see that one.
Did you see Simple Favor?
Not yet, and I hear it's great.
It's really
that's the
great.
Thriller one,
yeah,
right? I heard good things about that. Ryan Reynolds,
Blake Lively and Anna Kendrick. It's basically like suburban noir.
Right. It looked like a souped-up Lifetime movie, like a really
It absolutely is. But it goes into some really dark places. I spent like the last 2 weeks catching up on non-horror movies. What else I saw?
Traitor.
I saw Booksmart.
Booksmart
is fucking hilarious. Yeah. Godzilla. Godzilla's a blast.
We haven't talked about Godzilla.
I haven't seen it.
It came out. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. All the Godzilla. Jesus.
You're a believer.
I am. You know what? Listen, I thought Mike Doherty took a lot of big swings and knocked it out of the park. There's some great Godzilla stuff in it. There's a moment at the end with Rodan that I don't want to spoil. But I almost like teared up. I was like, Rodan!
So it was a lot of fan service.
A lot. Yeah. It was really annoying because we went open it the Thursday night, opening night. And it was a good crowd. It was really awesome because everybody was really, people were making Jet Jaguar jokes. People were talking about the kaiju they wanted to see. And there was a couple behind us and I thought they were friendlies. One had like a Godzilla plush. They were so loud. Like every time there was a triumphant Godzilla moment, they both like you thought they were at a sports arena and they just started screaming at the top of their lungs to the point where I was just like, shut up. And then that was it. They shut the fuck up. But it was like, come on, guys, we're all here for some good Monster Mash.
Did it follow the story after the first film? Like, did it feel like, did it feel like a sequel to that film, or did it feel slightly different? Was there good?
Oh no. I mean, like, it's overlapped.
Okay, yeah. There's one key plot point.
There's a major plot point.
That ties into it.
But I mean, they're very different movies in terms of approach. Yeah. I think that this film where Gareth with the first movie he told kind of this disaster movie, through his lens, his very specific lens of how he did monsters, you know, which was don't show too much of the monster, show the people on the ground, show how these Godzilla is a force of nature and how these Mutos are forces of nature. And there's something to be respected. I mean, I rewatched it and I think it's still, I don't mind the movie. The first time around, I was a little bummed out because I was like, I wanted more Godzilla.
Yeah.
But I respected his approach. Yeah. Mike, I think because they're trying to build out the Monsterverse, you know, Mike Dougherty brought in the, okay, you want a Godzilla and you want monsters, I'm going to give it to you. And he delivers big time on that. I also feel like there were other chefs in the kitchen that were going, okay, Mike, we also need some mythology. Please, like, layer in what the government's doing and what this kind of terrorist group is doing and what they're all after with the monsters and da-da-da-da. And you could feel that clash. And the human drama, and it's there's a lot to digest.
So the movie after this will be him versus King Kong?
They've already shot it.
Yeah, it's Godzilla versus Kong.
Kong versus Godzilla.
Talk about a huge leap.
Which they're going to push back because it was supposed to come out March 2020, but Toby Emmerich over at Warner Brothers said that they're going to take a little bit more time with it to deliver the best possible movie.
Okay.
So I think it means
part of the response to this, right? I guess because you're saying that element of monsters and human story didn't maybe work as well as they would have hoped.
You're definitely hoping for more monsters while you're going through the Kyle Chandler stuff.
Oh God. That's so funny. Is I remember Matt Serafini, who's an author and was on Dread Central. Somebody had wrote an article that was like, you can't just have 2 hours of monsters fighting. Like, that was their review of the movie.
What a bet.
And Matt Serafini retweeted saying, I reject your hypothesis.
I can't comment on that.
I would absolutely.
That's how I feel too.
Absolutely watch a predominantly dialogue-free monster movie with Godzilla just doing his thing.
Dialogue.
Because there's something in this movie that is really, really particularly cool in regards to like Godzilla's hangout spot.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, they're like, Godzilla's got a home. That's cool. Awesome. What else does he have? And I would just love to see him wandering the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the Hulk.
It's like wandering. It's the Kung Fu series. With Godzilla.
I do want to know what Godzilla does in between.
Yeah. What's he do?
It's fine.
I didn't want to know what Jason did. Jason, you remember the last Friday the 13th when you saw his lair? I was like, I don't want to know what he did.
Like,
I don't want to see his lair with like weird girl pinups. of the girl from part 3 that he abducted.
It's carving mom into wood.
Yeah. But that's good to hear. I'm glad real monster lovers love it. That's a lot of fun. That's good to hear.
Cool.
Yeah.
All righty. Well,
we got a cool guest.
We do.
We'll bring him on after this advertisement.
Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Mars Attacks has invaded Fright Rags with a brand new collection of tees and socks based on the 1960s trading cards. Get them before they get you. Coming next Wednesday, June 19th, the official Day of the Dead collection featuring new designs, classic tees, and reprints from past collections. Just don't choke on them. Use code WAVES10 for 10% off. That's WAVES10 for 10% off, and that's over at fright-rags.com. FRIGHT-RAGS.com.
And Graveyard Slaughter would like to tell you about their upcoming Kickstarter campaign. If you're old enough, you remember the joy of wandering the blissfully bloody aisles of the horror section of your local video store. Not those big, brightly lit stores of Blockbuster either. The hole-in-the-wall shops, that's what I'm talking about. The shops where you could find some deep-dive horror movies. Well, welcome to Video Hell. Lunchbox Press proudly invites you back to those video stores of old and presents Graveyard Slaughter, currently on Kickstarter. Graveyard Slaughter is a comic book anthology that is dripping with sloppy, ooey-gooey 80s VHS gore. Over 50 terrifying pages of madness co-written by New York Times bestselling author Cullen Bunn and Kevin Watkins. Art provided by legendary ghostwriter artist Javier Salteres, rising star, Pumpkinhead artist Blackie Shepherd, Gary Bedell, and Adam McLaughlin. Introduction provided by Bram Stoker award-winning and best-selling author Paul Tremblay. Hey, a friend. Graveyard Slaughter will be running on Kickstarter all through June. Graveyard Slaughter will be running on Kickstarter all through June. Back the comic book today to unlock all the super rad stretch goals exclusives only to Graveyard Slaughter Kickstarter backers. Lunchbox Press proudly presents Graveyard Slaughter on Kickstarter this month. And remember to always be kind, rewind, or die. Just head to Kickstarter.com and search for Graveyard Slaughter today. All right, welcome back. I am especially excited about our guest this week because it kind of ties thematically into a discussion that we seem to have on a reoccurring basis, which is about marketing and trailers and how much is too much in trailers and shouldn't you watch trailers at all and blah, 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 blah. I'm just going to read off the credits.
Oh, geez, yeah.
This guy has done some amazing, amazing trailer work for It Chapter 2, Our Halloween Movie, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the remake,
Ooh, Dawn
of
the Annihilation
Dead,
trailer was really
Annihilation.
Good. That's one I did watch.
Oh, I mean, like, all right, wait. Friday the 13th, 2009, Jason X, Split, Glass, Skeleton Key, Unsane, Exorcism of Emily Rose, Sinister, The Paranormal Activity series, that goes on and on. Chronicle, Trick or Treat. Let
all
us
the way
welcome
back to Scream 2.
Scream TV 4. Spot. Scream 4.
I did Scream 4 and I did Scream 2. Yeah. I just did some TV spots on Scream 2, some audience reaction spots. And then I did a spot for Scream, I think an audience reaction spot for that.
And the voice you're hearing is Bill Neal. Oh, yes. Let's welcome Bill to the podcast. Yeah. Bill.
Hi.
How are you, Bill?
I'm great. Bill, I'm glad to be here.
Bill, you and I have known each other quite a while. Mm-hmm. You are over at Buddha Jones.
Yep, Buddha Jones Trailers.
And just for those who don't know, around town there are companies that specifically create trailers.
Yes, there's a lot of companies. I mean,
there's
like
Trailer
40,
Park,
and,
yeah.
Trailer Park, AV Squad, Motion. There's a ton.
So just to clarify, so what happens is when a company like either Universal or Sony or ourselves, well, Blumhouse uses our distributor and their marketing savviness to pick the right people to create our trailers, but they outsource to these companies and they use your brain and your skills to push their films.
Yes. Yeah. We got assigned by the marketing execs at the studio who kind of, they steer the ship publicity wise and marketing wise. And then they decide which vendor or vendors get to have the shot at cutting a trailer for the movie. And, so they call us and usually a few other vendors too. For any trailer you see that's been multi-vended. So several vendors have probably worked on several totally different trailers and, one gets the win.
Yeah.
Wow. It's kind of like the effects world where you're all bidding on a gig, right?
Right.
And,
right.
You know, oh, this is the team that's going to.
Right. But this, well, luckily everybody gets paid pretty much.
Wow.
But
What's
you work
that like
they get paid, but there tends to be very little glory when you don't get the win, quote unquote. And you work for a long time and, yeah. You know, you put a lot, I mean, and you work for a long time on it. And then, you know, some of the others fall away. And then if you stick it out and maybe it's a bake off between two at the end and has a lot to do with, test marketing and also filmmakers and, you know, a lot of other factors.
Can I ask a really, origin story, origin question about, this is something I'd be genuinely curious about because we're always talking about, does a trailer ruin a film for someone? But here's a question. does cutting trailers ruin the film for you? Because I imagine you're not always getting a finished film.
Right. No, you don't. So in advance. Sometimes we start from the script phase. Sometimes we read the script before it's even shot. And sometimes we'll offer our input to the marketing, to the execs at the studio, what we think, you know, maybe when they're shooting, can they get coverage of this scene? Or we have an idea for a special shoot teaser. Other times we get a rough cut of the movie, or other times we get dailies of the movie, and we have to go through all the dailies.
So you guys are more like the guys writing the novelizations in the 80s. Yes. Without having seen it, you're like, I'm just going to write this crazy ending.
But we have to see everything sometimes, you know. And, I mean, it can be a lot of, information to ingest, and we have to go a lot faster than they do on the feature side where they're cutting the feature. You know, usually we'll have to, like, if it's from a dailies project, we got to go through all the dailies and have a cut way before, like, a first cut is done of the feature.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're going to skip around a lot and have a lot of questions, but let's walk through some of the process a little bit, because sometimes the studio will bring you in early enough where you can read a script, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Is it different? Is it on a case by case basis how you approach it, in terms of, like, you know, okay, well, this is what this is about. Do they tell you what they're looking for? Or is that part of your pitch process? Like, oh, this is what we think how we could start.
Right. Well, I think I've been doing this for a while, so I kind of have a reputation. So a lot of the studios do trust me and kind of ask me what I think. But, you know, also, you know, there's a lot of times the studio does have kind of an idea of how they want to go about presenting the movie to the world. So, you know, it's a case by case basis. But, you know, basically we get the project, we'll get the script, or we'll get the rough feature. And it's about our reaction to it. You read it or you watch it, and it's, you know, you try to watch it as an audience member or read it as an audience member and how you would react to it. I'm a huge film fan, so I always go in with open eyes and excited for whatever. And also, you try not to be a cynic too, especially in this side of the job, because when you are getting either dailies or a rough cut of the movie, it's not finished, and it is not fair to ever judge the quality of the movie necessarily, because it could completely change, you know. And there've been times when I've seen roughs of movies and I'm like, geez. And then it comes out and it gets, you know, good reviews. And then I go see it and I'm like, oh, wow, they really turned that around. And then the same, you know, the opposite, you know, can be said too. And
did
I think something's great.
Did they take notes from you guys on the actual feature, not the trailer? Like, has that ever?
Rarely. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is that in some, you know, for those astute viewers, you'll notice in some trailers there's alternate takes and alternate line readings. And that's where where you come into play, because you're getting that stuff off of dailies.
Off of dailies. Like for one example is Halloween.
Yeah.
So, I was going to bring that
up. So like the take by the way, for Halloween, we worked up dailies for that. And because Halloween's my number one favorite movie, I was super excited to work on it.
Let me just stop you right there for a second. So Bill is an integral part of Slashback Video. Oh. I just want to let you guys know that when we did Slashback Video year one, he was one of our key sponsors. He donated a ton of stuff.
Wow.
And thankfully, because of his office, you took pictures and you were like, Ryan, I've got all this stuff in my office. Put it in Slashback Video, please. And it was just a shrine to Halloween. I mean, it was just all these VHS tapes. I mean, it was insane. And then the Laserdisc collection anyway.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I had a fetish Halloween VHS. And like the first VHS release is like by Mita Home Entertainment, not even Media. And I spent years trying to get it on eBay. And like it was legendary, because at one point I started bidding really high and I brought the price up so high. And then it just, I stopped doing it because the person who was trying to sell it was probably scamming. But I finally got it, and it's part of Slashback. Nice.
Yes, it is.
Wow. Is that the TV cut of the movie? Because that was the first one I bought by accident.
No, this is the old, it's like a yellow and blue stripes.
It's got the yellow frame, and then it's got the little blue triangle at the bottom. And in some cases, it says Media. As a writing
media, but the one before that was MEDA, M-E-D-A, and it's the worst transfer. It's horrible because that's how I first saw it when I was a kid. Yeah. And like I remember when the scene where he's standing in the sheets and you see him say, it was so blurry you couldn't tell he was in the sheets. Like I was like, what? What's that music?
I'm so excited about it. I don't understand. It's blurry.
It's just what is that? I think something scary is happening.
Time to do the linens.
Oh, so when the Laserdisc came out and it was letterbox, oh my god, the cartoons. Anyway, so you know I was a huge fan of Halloween. So, and I always, you know, give 100% no matter what. I gave kind of 150% on this. I combed through those dailies and I knew. And every once in a while, I would like send Ryan a text just to be like, this shot's amazing. I mean, we kind of have to stay kind of separate production versus marketing. Yeah. So, because I answer to the marketing people at Universal. And through them is our liaison with Blumhouse and Ryan. So, but I was just saying how much, because everybody knew I was a fan at Universal and they knew I was communicating. I was like, this is the tracking shot. I just saw the tracking shot. Yeah. And he was like, it's cool, Ryan. I'm like, yes, this is amazing. So anyway, so I looked at everything and, going through that. So yeah, so you get to the Halloween trailer. And so like a Jamie Lee Curtis line, like, why am I blanking on? She goes, I have to kill him. What's the line?
Oh, it's I know what you're talking about. What is it?
Why on earth? Why on earth would you do that? So I can kill him.
So I can kill him.
Yeah.
So the take I used when I saw the first cut of the feature, I was like, oh, that's different, you know, because I used a different take. The take I used, I think, worked really well in terms of the timing for the trailer.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes that is different. So that is why, you know, sometimes having the dailies can make it a little bit easier.
Yeah. Well, it was fascinating to see your process versus Tim Alverson's process in the edit room, you know, in terms of the way the closet scene was timed out. And
I like my closet timing, but that's because of me.
I told him that too. I was like, why is the closet shot different than in the trailer?
I know.
Sorry, Tim. I like the trailer.
That's the only thing I'll say is that, yeah, I kind of like the way I did it without the extra cuts, but it worked. It's there's so many things that go into these decisions and stuff, trailer wise and feature wise. So,
I was going to say, since we're talking about Halloween, because I do want to bring some specifics, because there's so many horror trailers. It's very impressionable to us because this is our first taste of a lot of these movies, especially things we love. So, Halloween, for example, first trailer was great. I remember Ryan let us see it just a tiny bit early. Mm-hmm. And we're like, ooh, okay, so that's what you're doing. Second trailer for that.
That makes my heart so happy.
Yeah. No. Well, because again, there's mysteries. You don't know. Is it a sequel? Is it not? Whatever. Yeah, and then you see it and you understand what that movie is right from that first trailer. Like, oh, okay, this is where we're picking up. But then the second trailer, for example, this falls into Elric's spoiler territory. It's a cool trailer that shows you a really cool chunk of the movie, that one long tracking shot of Michael going from house to house. Now, I thought that was awesome when I saw it.
Right.
But, you know, how do you feel going into something that you know is going to be a significant part of the movie? Or is that just – and Ryan, from your perspective too, it's like, all right, we know we got those people, but this is for – we got to get everybody else.
That's exactly
how you approach it.
Yes, that's exactly. Because I've heard you guys speak about trailers because I listen to this podcast all the time since episode one. When Ryan has talked about trailers, like he talked about the Carrie trailer, kind of giving everything away. It's something that's happened for a long time, and it's about trying to cast as wide a net for as big an audience as possible. And if you're kind of sold on it and you want to see it, you shouldn't, you know, I wouldn't suggest watching the trailer. I tend not to watch trailers, especially for movies I want to see. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll watch like the first 20 seconds. I'll be like, okay, I got it. You know, this is what this is. But that is showing a little bit more is about, you know, again, like I said, casting a wider net and trying to get more people interested. And that tracking shot is just so cool. It's really good. Like, you know, in my perfect world where you just make trailers for fans, horror trailers for fans, I would have just liked that like 2-minute scene and that's it. Or even better than that, the thing that we used for the digital announcement of the first trailer was Lori singing, I Wish I Had You All Alone and shooting and then walking away and then playing the theme. And I'm like, I'm there. I'm going to go. And so is every other horror fan. But the fans who don't know, or even horror fans who don't are that specific, that first trailer really explains the story. You know, it's like the Brady Bunch theme. You know, it's a story of lovely lady. Right, like you want to explain and get everybody on board. And then, you know, and then it's a matter of, you know, showing, you know, you get the story. So you see Michael and then you introduce Jamie Laurie. Mm-hmm. And then you say that, then you bring in the John Carpenter card. Yeah. And this is the thing about making that trailer. It's like, where do we bring in the theme? It's like once all the elements are together, okay, the band is back together, boom, kick the theme in and make it, you know, kind of give you chills. So.
Yeah, because you're not trying to get cinephiles. Like people like me, we're going to already be in and wanting to see the movie, so we probably don't
want to spoil movies.
But I, what I've been doing is like sometimes if I don't want to see too much, I won't watch things. But something I'll often do is watch the first 30 seconds of a trailer, get the tone, and go, oh, cool, I know what it is now, but now I'm just going to close my eyes and hear it.
Right.
And still get like The Witch. That really helped me with The Witch because I didn't.
Right.
I saw, oh, I see what the film, but I don't want to see any of the key imagery for some reason. But then I'm not the mark. I'm not who you have to market to. You have to get the, you know,
yeah,
the majority
for a movie like The Witch or some of the, like the A24.
Annihilation is a great example.
Right. Well, I did the trailer. I didn't do the teaser. The teaser is very much, it's much, just more tonal. The trailer shows a lot more. Again, because like the teaser is just about, teasers are meant to get like just a taste of tone and a tiny sense of story. And, you know, those are kind of the most fun to cut because it's storytelling within 2.5 minutes can be tough. So it's nice to just get a tone, and that's really important. And that's a matter of music and sound and image. It's, you know.
Can we talk about the brilliance of the Congo trailer? I mean, you might not be responsible, but it is one of the greatest trailers of all time. I just love the balls on that. It's just like a tracking shot, blurry with sounds. You're like, who would go see that movie?
You think about the time too.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, yeah, no, exactly. I felt like the '90s were doing some really fun things. You know, there was God, what was some of the standout trailers? I really liked the Congo trailer.
No, I mean, I was so in on that trailer, not knowing anything about it.
I remember Judge Dredd. I was super into. But they were doing.
I worked on TV spots for Judge Dredd.
Oh, did you really? Well, it's interesting because, you know, each decade definitely has its own style. Like, you know, in terms of its own narrator, you always recognize the same voice. Right. And you always, and it was always had its own, the same rhythm. Today, I feel like every single trailer has that kind of slow cover song.
Right,
playing
that's
over
a new thing.
Playing over something devastating.
Yes,
it's so, just a really hammer home the gravity of what we're
but
seeing.
But who started that, Ryan? Was it the Gallows?
The Gallows was pretty far into that. Yeah. You know, there was. Yeah.
I'm teasing.
I think there's. You know,
what's a Gallows?
I'm trying
to think of who it is because of the Terminator. Trends. I just saw the Terminator one on the big screen, and everybody was like, "Oh, what's that song? What's that song?
It's the Bjork.
The Bjork song. Yeah.
Right.
Because before that it was Dark Phoenix, and before that it was something. There was this thing. Now, when do you think that peters out?
I think when it starts getting parodied, and there've been, internet memes about cover songs. And actually, I was having a discussion with somebody that they were like, so is it, can we use them again? Because it felt like 2 years ago we were talking about it. But sometimes it's like, another thing about making trailers is like, no one's ever half-assed about it. We try to turn over every stone. No, you can never say like the marketing people haven't tried. Up until the day it opens, we are trying to make sure that people want to see the movie. And that they're not too spoiled for the movie, because you don't want people leaving your movie and feel like, you know, they were duped, because then they're not going to tell other people to go see it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so sometimes, you know, like that slow cover song, sometimes it still does work and you're like, I don't want to, but this will work here.
Pixies have been used a bunch for that.
For sure.
Or the end of movies. Yeah.
Go ahead, Bill.
Well, so like the trailer style. Yeah. It's constantly evolving. You know, the VO, you know, narrator was big in the 90s.
Yeah.
And
when did that peter out? I'm trying to think of like when the big narrator who had
I just try to think about my trailers that have had VO on it. And even like I did a trailer for Jeepers Creepers 2, which had a narrator on it. And I was like, I'd rather just have the cards. But sometimes the cards will come up on screen and they'll read them too. But that was kind of through the 90s. And then 2000s, they kind of just started peeling back the narrator. For TV spots, they tend to have a narrator because a lot of people aren't really paying attention to the visuals as much. So yeah, around the 2000s, I think narrators really kind of went, every once in a while they'll be in there for a trailer. And I think what's kind of the trend, especially lately, it's about trying to feel less like marketing and more like just less sweaty is like a term a lot of people like to use. Like the, like we're not pushing as hard. We're just letting, we're trying to make it seem as, you know, let the movie speak for itself as if it's speaking for itself, even though a lot of like backflips are being done for it. So, you know, sometimes maybe it's a little less style, a little, you know, and just letting a scene play out or making it feel less imposed editorially. Sometimes there's really cool editorial that makes you excited, but then sometimes what I think that can make you feel is that these marketing people are imposing this style and they're trying too hard to make it look cool. Mm. So you just want to let it play and be cool for itself or kind of ride that line.
Well, what's interesting, I was going to say, you talk about letting scenes play, you know, it chapter two, has blown up the internet and oh my God, when I saw Godzilla and they showed that trailer, everybody was losing minds. Losing their minds.
But isn't it weird that like, cause this is a trailer you cut. They're like, all over town. I've seen it twice now. All over town, there were ads for the trailer.
I think it's trailer Thursday. They did that first, I think, for us.
Halloween trailer.
I was so excited for, that's the first time I noticed it for a trailer for it. I was very wild. Excited.
And they changed it. That morning, I drove by one and it said, now online. Yeah. I'm like, oh, wow.
I have that poster in my office. Somebody just gave it to me. I'd never heard of that. Except for before with us. And that was that's really exciting.
But it's fun. It's an interesting thing to see because you and I had a little bit of a sidebar conversation about it because I was lamenting. I was like, oh, but I want some more artistry to it. But it was something I think I noticed when they did The Conjuring.
Oh, The Conjuring.
They did like the clap scene.
Which I think is on your list.
No, yeah. I did trailer too.
The full trailer. Okay.
Right.
But that was, I mean, I love that. I love the idea of here's a scene and you're just like, basically it's the equivalent of your 30 seconds. You're like, okay, I'm in. I get a little flavor of that movie. I want to see it.
Right. Yeah. That I love that teaser. That was done at Buddha Jones as well. I wish I could work on every horror movie that comes in. Booty Jones has a lot of horror movies and I want to work on every and I can't. You know, I remember I was like, oh, I wish I could do it. But this editor, Miko, did a great job on that teaser. But like that teaser doesn't touch on the Warrens.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, you know, the second trailer, that's kind of the, you know, but it was to like, I think the point of that teaser was really to make it seem legit scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, because in 2.5 minutes, getting the story of the Warrens and making it feel as good as that teaser did is very tough. So,
yeah.
You've worked on, I mean, like looking at all the big guns, you know, it was Texas Chainsaw, Dawn of the Dead, Amityville, Prom Night, Nightmare on Elm Street,
the Freddy remake Jason, train that I was on in the early 2000s.
All of it. What was happening at that time in terms of, you know, cutting trailers? I mean, like Texas Chainsaw, I remember being astounded by it. Like,
that was my big
trailer. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have kind of two phases of my career. The first part, pre-Texas and post-Texas. So before Texas, I got lucky enough to work on Jason X, was that after? Yeah, Jason X was before. Yep. And, you know, Scream, a couple things here and there. But I did mostly I did a lot of comedy. And even though I've been a lifelong horror fan, I mean, again, the 90s weren't that great for horror movies, as we all know. Right. And so then I did the Texas trailer, and which got a lot of recognition both like by the general public and by kind of the quote unquote trailer community. And a lot of people really responded to it.
Had the Mike, I think it's called the Michael Bay teaser. Had that existed?
As a sales teaser.
Yeah. Because I remember they showed that at a Fangoria Weekend of Horrors.
Right.
I remember that.
But everybody booed. Because they're like, no, don't remake that.
Well, that was like one of the first remakes. Yeah. And I really like that movie. And again,
I did too. And that teaser's super cool.
Yeah, the teaser's cool. I'm very proud of that trailer too. It's,
like the photography flashes.
Yeah. I had the song to the siren, that cover of Song to the Siren at the beginning. And then I had like this, the record kind of heartbeat.
That's right. Yeah.
And then, the flashes and then the all in black part that we took from the, Michael Bay teaser. Mm-hmm. And then we had this big, huge orchestral cue. And we were, the thinking behind the whole thing was to, that we only see one chainsaw in the whole thing. So we were like, because we saw the movie and I really thought the movie was great, but it was, especially for 2003 before Saw and everything came out, it was pretty, it was brutal. And even the rough cut was even brutal, more brutal.
Wow.
But I thought it was shot beautifully, which I thought was interesting as a counterpoint to the original. And even though it was the same DP. And so we thought, let's go super elevated to call something the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but do something super elevated, was kind of our approach. Mm-hmm. And not just, not kind of wallow in like suffering or pain, but do, you know, and, so anyway, so that trailer got a lot of traction and a lot of interest, and the movie opened really well.
Yeah.
And it kind of, I think, had an effect on trailers after that.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of my trailers too.
Well, you made a lot of the Platinum Dunes movies. I know I have no problem saying it, as Brad Fuller was on the show, way better than they actually were. And I'll give you a clear example: like Nightmare on Elm Street could be the one of the worst remakes ever made until Child's Play opens next week. But that trailer is amazing.
Spoiler.
No, the Nightmare on Elm Street trailer is really impressive.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it makes you, you know, because we're all skeptical, right, about it. Like,
but
you can't,
but there are scenes and there are
scenes.
Oh,
you were on set for that, weren't you?
Yeah, I was on set for that, weirdly enough. But there are scenes in that Nightmare on Elm Street that are beautiful and great. It's just as a movie, it doesn't come together. Right. So as a trailer editor, that's lucky for you, right? Because at least there's some great visuals to work with.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah. I mean, for all the remixes, it's been Platinum Dunes, and Brad Fuller was awesome on this.
Yeah,
and the Platinum Dunes guys, I really love them. The number one, like Texas Chainsaw, kind of catapulted my career, and they were always loyal and respectful, and they were trying to be respectful of those franchises.
Oh, for sure.
They always wanted to make the best movie possible. Uh-huh. If it didn't turn out, like you would read on the internet, these people being like, they're just assholes, and they, you know, they wanted, you know, and I remember on Elm Street, like they, you know, worked to make it as good a movie as possible. It just, you know, didn't necessarily. And again, I remember on that I was getting dailies. Well, no, I think that was from a rough cut. And again, like I couldn't judge. I just had to find what I loved about it and hope that, you know, if it wasn't working, that it would get better. And they were shooting more dream sequences and things like that. Mm. So in like all the remakes, I was, you know, I really, you
yeah,
know,
I was looking,
had a soft spot for
most. I've
got
like seven pages here. I was like, you know, like the Prom Night, and then also
Prom Night was big for me because that like was my number two slasher. I love the original Prom Night. I just watched it again on Blu-ray. I'm like, this movie's not bad. And on that trailer, I tried to put some Easter eggs, which didn't come through, but I tried to use one of the, because I had the Japanese vinyl of the soundtrack for Prom Night, and I tried to use one of the disco songs, I kind of like reverbed it out, and like, because in Prom Night, during one of the scenes, they're running around the school, they're chasing Wendy, and you hear the reverberant disco beat, and it's really creepy. I tried to do that in the trailer, but it didn't. That didn't make the final version.
See, that's what I love. I mean, like you're in the horror fan corner, trying to push for these things. Yeah,
I try to do little Easter eggs, like Unsane, the trailer for Unsane that
that
did.
That was a really good trailer.
Yeah, I used the music that I picked for the opening of that trailer. I watched the movie, and I really liked that movie. But it gave me like the tone I was feeling was Cronenberg's Rabid. Yeah. So I went and I found the needle drop that he used like five times in that movie. And that's the music I used in the opening of the Unsane trailer. Yeah. And I'm like, I hope somebody gets it. And it's on purpose. I'm not ripping anything off. Like, you know, like, Like, I remember, for Friday the 13th, I did the teaser, which I love, and the trailer, which I love, which we reprise the countdown from the original trailer.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember reading people who are like, they're just ripping it off. It's kind of an homage. Yeah, don't you think I know what's going on? And just try to update it.
Challenging, because I love anytime I meet someone behind the scenes who's this passionate and like has that kind of breadth of knowledge, it always gets me excited myself. But how challenging is it when you see a rough cut or a film that you don't personally believe in without going into titles? Or is it just a matter of you have to just get yourself in a mindset of, okay, maybe it's not for me, but I'm going to make it for I will help it find its audience. Is that what you have to do? What does that process
look? I got to tell you, I usually, especially with horror, I try to look through rose colored glasses and I usually find stuff that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
You know, and so I believe in that. Again, it's like I said, it's all, you always have to be like, you know, it's a rough cut. I've rarely worked in a movie where I'm like, ugh, this is just, there's nothing. And yeah, I guess good, one movie I'll say, okay, yeah, which I didn't get the finish on.
Okay.
So I'm still, I also, when I work on a movie, because, you know, I've worked on tons of campaigns and trailers that have not, I've never seen the light of day because somebody else won whatever the bake-off was. So I'm always a little bit more bitter about those movies. I'm less inclined to go see them or like them. But the one I don't feel bad about, say, I hated The Fog. Remake.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, I got
that. We all did. And yet the movie
I know you all did, but coming from me, like Fog is one of my favorite movies. Yeah, and I remember I was getting the dailies and being like, Selma Blair, please deliver that line better.
Wow. One of our listeners is in that film, so a friend of ours, Matt Perry Holmes. He knows how bad it is though, so it's okay.
And I wish
shout out to Matt.
But you kind of look at the shots and they're actually very pretty. No, the director, he did Stigmata. Which is a beautiful looking movie and stuff.
No, visually it has, again, it has moments. So I imagine as an editor, you still see interesting moments, interesting.
Right. But, even when I was working on that movie, again, it didn't get finished. But then like if I'm feeling a little lacking, I try to find some like a piece of music that might inspire me that I feel could connect with it. And for that, I use this cue from Irreversible called Rectum.
Oh, yeah.
And it kind of goes, and I use that as, and I had like this graphic of a lighthouse spinning, kind of bringing shots on and off. And it was cool. It didn't see the light of day, but.
I like the way your brain thinks here. I like that you go to Irreversible for a fog remake.
But see, when an idea doesn't get used, sometimes I recycle it and I use it in Insidious 2, I think we used it. Trailer for that.
Well, how much freedom do you have when it comes to music choices or score or whatever? Like, and you know what I mean? Like, do you start with something or suggest something, then people respond to it?
Yes. Like, that's usually what happens. That? Yeah. Yes. So the, you know, cause the scores are not done when we're working on these. And even sometimes when we do, like, for a fairly finished movie that has sometimes even a rough score, a lot of times it's for marketing purposes, for the energy you need in that 2.5 minutes, they're not right. So yeah, we'll find music, and there's a lot, and it's been growing and growing. There's tons and tons of libraries that make music specifically for trailers. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's like got to be over 150 libraries. And so they're constantly releasing stuff, constantly changing sounds. And I mean, they sound amazing and they work really well. And I also have stuff I squirrel away, weird music, weird things from the past, like Unsane, like just these things that just inspire me. And, I'll pick something and pick different cues for a trailer. And then, you know, you present the V1 and it goes to revision. I mean, sometimes we go up to version 80, but when it comes time or close to time to getting out in the world, then they have to license and see how much things cost. And so sometimes that will have to go and replace stuff that's too expensive.
Yeah, what kind of budgets does that go up to? Because I remember the one, I know you didn't cut this trailer, but I remember the legendary recent one was Your Next, when it used A Perfect Day by Lou Reed. Because Lou Reed is famously expensive, I
right.
guess.
Yeah, I cut a trailer like for Your Next that they did use SourceBot. No,
but I remember hearing there was like $1 million track or something and being like, I don't know if that's just an urban legend. But
oh, no, because Lou Reed hated horror, apparently.
Right, but that it was going to cost that much. But yet it worked using that track.
Right.
Because it's in the movie, but
it depends. Like, and again, the music budget isn't usually something that the studio will share with us. Mm. They will just say we can't afford that. Right, they won't say we have this amount. But you start to know, like, okay, it's this amount. If you use something from a score, they tend to be a little bit more expensive. The music libraries tend to be like, you know, a certain number, and then songs can be crazy, like surprisingly cheap or surprisingly like. It costs that much for that artist, and they haven't had a hit forever, and this is the first time they're using it? What? Mm-hmm. You know, and then there's some people who, like, what's one? Jason X, going back a little bit. So I cut that with Marilyn Manson, and then they didn't license it. So I let the body hit the floor. I picked that.
Yeah.
They just did an episode on How Did This Get Made, that podcast, where they just kept singing. I was like, it's because of me. And so I picked that in my desperation. I had 2 days.
But that's what I remember about that trailer.
Yes.
Is that, yeah. That's that song playing it.
Right.
Well, another interesting example, because I also want to delve into, I mean, you have this incredible list of movies, but then not getting the credit for these trailers. But so something like Freddy versus Jason, which I love that trailer.
Uh-huh.
And
Joe Bishara music.
And I was just about to say another unsung thing is that Joe Bishara did the music for that. Yeah. So how did that happen? Did you have a piece of music and then they're like, we can't afford that, but we know this composer guy that can do it.
So, so kind of getting back a little bit, just circling around. So Texas Chainsaw with its sound design and stuff like that, that kind of became something that people really liked. And I started to, you know, really push the sound design in terms of trailers. And Joe Bishara is a friend of mine. We kind of became friends because of this, but he was an early composer for trailers.
Yeah.
So he would have CDs of tracks he made specifically for trailers or for movies he scored, and he would like break them down. And so that trailer was cut to that cue that I got from a Joe Bishara CD that he had given me. And Joe Bishara, like, is an amazing composer.
Yeah.
And a lot of the intense sound design that's in trailers now is, you know, you can trace back to some of the really interesting stuff that he did back, you know, 19 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so, that's interesting too, because I think he told me one of his firsts was Strange Days, maybe.
Yeah,
Strange Days was cut to a Nine Inch Nails song that he couldn't use.
Right,
and so he's like, I could do something like that, no problem.
Yeah, no, he's we've used him to score actual trailers when like just redo the whole music bed when certain cues, you know, can't come. But I tend to like to just be inspired by his music.
Yeah,
you know, and he would send me, you know, roughs of stuff he was working on, and I would use that, and you know, screeches and squeals and stuff. He was really good with that stuff.
Well, what about like the Conjuring movies? Did you use his stuff?
The score hadn't been done yet.
Right.
So I didn't. I probably so within every like sound design bed of a trailer, there's a ton of cues, even some for like 1 second, 20 frames, you know, like sometimes there's, you know, when I have a cue sheet, that's less than 50 cues within a trailer. And these are all like small hits and whooshes that you have to pay for. But that's usually a surprise to my music supervisor that there's less than that. So, yeah.
Wow.
And are you part of the testing process of trailers? Or is that more for like the Joe Weese's Universal like marketing team or Sony?
Well, we just get the bad news usually, or the good news.
Yeah.
So yeah, they'll decide what they want to test, you know, and usually be multiple trailers, sometimes a couple of mine or a couple of other people's. And, you know, they go out and testing companies like NRG or MarketCast, they go out and they go show trailers to people around the country and like in malls and stuff, and they get their reaction, and then we hear about like the scores for them. Right. And you know, and a lot of times, you know, you think you're really clear about storytelling, and this is where I find it valuable. And then you get response back, and like, people didn't get that, they don't understand. So
similar to the movie experience too.
Yeah. Exactly. Yes.
Obviously, because it's marketing, you're constantly dealing with a client and there's notes back and forth. Have you ever had a trailer that you've cut and it was just like, yes, without any discussion?
There are stories in the business about that, but there have been some that have been very easy. Texas Chainsaw was a very easy one. Yeah. Like, it was like version 3, and we actually, this never happens. I had to go with the studio person and present it to Michael Bay.
Nice.
Oh, wow. And so he put the three, this is when we were outputting on 3/4, he put the 3/4 in, he pressed play, he watched it, and he turned and he smiled at everybody. And then after that meeting, somebody runs up to us and says, he never does that. Awesome. He had that's one great note.
Yeah.
And and then
because
he brought
us in. People think they have to give notes, right? Even if there aren't notes needed, people, because of the job.
Get their two cents, you know, filmmakers, not as much, right. You know, they'll like express concern about, you know, certain things or tonally if they don't think we have it. But, you know, the notes for notes' sake, I think, come, you know, might come in some of the, you know, the the layers in between. Yeah. But, you know, usually I think there's most notes I get, I think, have a good reason, even if I don't agree with them. You know, they're coming from a certain thought process that sometimes, you know, I think notes are bad and then they'll make them the piece better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Spoilers. I do want to touch on it because it's controversial part or twists. It's not really about spoilers because I'm not like a big spoiler. I don't really care what people put out in the culture. It's up to me what I want to ingest and watch. Mm-hmm. Right. But like with twists, how obviously it's not completely up to you guys what parts of the story to put out there.
Oh, a perfect example is Pet Sematary. Right. We did those.
So I never got that. So when I went into the theater, I saw the teaser and then
he didn't see any of
it. I loved the teaser. I knew nothing.
He was surprised.
There's even people holding up posters at trivia and somehow I missed seeing the girl. For me, and I will just say, like, when I saw that movie, man, I was shocked the direction. I was like, oh shit, they're going that way.
Right.
Kind of, but again, it doesn't mean it's going to ruin it. It's just going to change your perspective. But like, how much does that weigh into?
You guys had the directors on too. So luckily, because that's such a recent movie, it's hard for me to speak too much of it. But they said exactly what kind of the thinking was, you know, in terms of just of that plot element. Again, it's only for people who really know the story. If that is a twist. And if you don't do that, then it's like, what else is there to show to people who don't know that story?
Yeah.
It becomes a very difficult thing, you know, and, one movie I got really slammed for on the trailer that, story wise was Dream House. That trailer got
the Daniel Craig movie.
The Daniel Craig movie.
It's a remake of a Japanese film, though, right?
No, that's not. Dream Home, which is the slasher.
So it's a remake.
No, this was Daniel Craig and Rachel Weisz, and there's a big twist in the movie that and it was in, and I read the script first, and even when I was reading that, it seemed like the twist was something we'd probably need to show because otherwise we wouldn't be able to tell much of a story. Right. The story would have just been so, you know, just thin that it wouldn't have been compelling.
Yeah.
So that was a tough one. We got, you know, I remember, I still believe in what we did.
Yeah.
For that movie, but we got kind of, you know, somebody's, you know, when you read worst trailer ever, the person who edited his trailer is an idiot.
Have you ever been at odds on the opposite though, which is like you see all the stuff, the studio says, oh yeah, we got to show this. And you're like, well, have you ever found yourself trying to defend or protect story elements?
No, I think we're all on the same page. The studio pretty much everybody I've encountered, they're not like from studio, highest studio part down. Mm. Everybody wants to protect what the movie is, but they want to also make sure they make, you know, it's such an investment, you know, so, and people do take risks, and I'm always, you know, happy with that. And sometimes, I've done a trailer and they're like, oh, we shouldn't show that. And I'm like, okay.
Really, really quickly, because you sent us a list of certain things, and one thing that never got released, which I thought was fascinating, and it kind of ties into the spoiler conversation. You showed us a trailer that you did for Cabin in the Woods.
Yes. Yeah.
Before it was at the studio that ended up releasing it. And I watched it and I thought it was, I don't even know if I could describe it. It's really cool because it's basically just panning on the cabin with dialogue, and then the screen splits into three, like almost like three monitors. Yeah. Right. And then you're getting flashes of everything. But the thing is, I thought it was awesome because I've seen the movie.
Right.
And I understand what you're referencing. I don't know if I feel like Cabin in the Woods is an impossible trailer to cut.
Right. Well, right? They did a great job. I didn't do the trailer that got released. And that was supposed to be a teaser that made people be like, what the fuck is going on? There's that pedigree of Joss Whedon and Drew Goddard.
Right.
And like, it starts like, oh, you'd think, oh, it's about a cabin in the woods, and you hear what they're saying. Unfortunately, people can't see this, but, and then it just goes off the rails. And there was a lot of chatter about that, you know, about the movie before any footage was released. And there was a lot of excitement about it. And I thought it was a really neat way to kind of like stoke interest, you know, and it was about to be, you know, released, and then the studio changed, and, you know, a lot of politics involved with that, but it was something that was going to see the light of day. And that was one of my biggest disappointments that it didn't, because I was really interested to see what people, what people would think.
Well, because I was, that also suffered at the hands of also like pushes, release date pushes and stuff.
Wasn't
like
there
that.
A 3D so conversion like, yeah. at one point? Like, yeah. oh, they're going to make it, they're going to make it 3D.
So. Right, right. Yeah. And it suffered that and just like changing of the guard, just so many politics. But yeah, I mean, I was on the mix stage with Joss Whedon and we were mixing it and then
Do you get blown? I mean, because like seeing a movie like that before anyone else and before knowing much about it, do movies still blow your mind when they come in and no one else is talking about it yet, and you just see that and you go, oh, shit.
Yeah. Well, that was that movie. Cabin in the Woods was from script stage.
Okay. Yeah.
And that was also from dailies, which that movie, I like that movie. It turned out different than I anticipated. Reading it, the killer family that comes out sounded like it'd be a lot scarier. I thought it was going to be scarier. I was a little disappointed when I saw it all together. I was like, oh, they're not like, it's not that creepy. They're just kind of going, you know, but the second half of that movie is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
What were we saying?
I'm just curious if there's still movies when they come in that just blow you away where you're like, oh,
yes.
Wow.
When you get a cut of the movie. Yeah. I mean, one that, came in and I was supposed to work on, but I didn't get a chance to. It was after the trailer had already come out, but I hadn't seen it, but Hereditary.
Yeah.
They did some digital stuff, at my work for that. But, that trailer was cut by a guy named Tommy Malatestin. That trailer is great. Yeah. Did you see that trailer, Harry?
I don't know if I saw all of it. I definitely saw a taste of it. Yeah. The film blew me away. So it's like usually
every season I try to make him go watch it.
I will say sometimes like I did see the first ones for us and I'll be in the theater and I'll be like, I am so fucking sold on the, like, you know what I mean? I'll see, say this first trailer, whatever it is. And then after that, I definitely won't need to see a follow up, no matter how great.
Right.
Until after the movie. And it's just, it's just a personal choice.
No,
because
that's what I do too. I don't even watch any trailer because I do watch some. I mean, I watch trailers for my business, but you know, there's something that David Lynch once said, which always sticks in my head and it's about like for cinephiles who watch like trailers, it just becomes a shot list in your head. So when you watch the movie, you're suddenly making a checklist in your head of, oh, I saw that shot. But that's impossible to, you know, to get away from.
Yeah.
You know, just the nature of the beast.
I think I changed it after quarantine trailer. I'm not even joking where that, it was just because I had seen, obviously it didn't really matter because it's not a spoiler because I'd seen Rex. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I knew everything, but it was just seeing that in the trailer going, oh, like, but that's the end. And then so having after that going,
No one else knew that.
And so I think it makes sense here, but it's like for those of us who are already in anyway, we're already also going to go to almost anything that's horror, right? So it's like, you don't have to sell us.
Yes.
You
know? Right.
But the artistry of trailers, I mean, the one thing I miss a little bit, and I know it's probably impossible now, was like some of those crazy trailers that we're seeing in the 70s. Like It Lives or Suspiria, where it's a weird.
Yeah. Oh, you mean it's a live trailer with the basket and the claw.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes we pitch ideas like that, and sometimes they might even get shot. It just depends. You know, I mean, the studios only have a certain number of targets they can hit. And, you know, are they going to want to hit something that just is very niche, you know, and that's their only chance to get a watch, like, again,
right.
You know, you throw that net, you know, I love teasers like that too.
I just don't know if they would play now, but I would love them, but I don't know about Mass America. Right. I have no idea.
Well, the thing, you know, trailers are about like, you know, trying to sell this product and it's really hard. You know, it's almost like, there's this metaphor that people use is that a trailer is like trying to sell a jigsaw puzzle, but instead of on the box where they show you the whole picture, you only get to have five pieces of that puzzle and you got to make, you know, the person want to buy that puzzle based on those five pieces. They don't know what it's going to look like ultimately, but like, what pieces do we put together to make it look like that? It's a remix of the movie as well.
What's interesting about that too, is there's this thing now where if you watch, say you put on a trailer on YouTube and there's like a trailer debut, what they'll do is offer you a 10-second snippet of that trailer.
Five-second bumper.
The trailer starts.
And then it's like, trailer starts now. And you're like, oh, what is that for? And it's to like give them a sneak preview of what they're about to invest 2 minutes and 45 seconds of their life too.
Right. Well,
which
I think
is
it's
so nuts to me.
I'm not as knowledgeable about the digital side in that, but I think the point of that is to grab people quickly.
Yeah.
You know, because some trailers, you might start out, the first 30 seconds just setting a mood sometimes. So that 5 seconds is meant to grab you. Personally, I am never a fan if I go look at one of my trailers and that's at the beginning, because just like watching a movie, I'm like, oh, well, that's a checklist for the trailer. Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's wild.
But there are some there's some I love that make, like, I actually think the Unsane one, I haven't seen it recently, but I would have watched it anyway because it's Soderbergh, mm-hmm. but it made me have to watch the movie. Because there were still lots of twists mm-hmm. in that movie to discover,
Right.
It gave enough of a flavor of this is the kind of movie you're going to watch. This is Soderbergh doing something different, psychological. And then I remember watching the movie having no idea some of the turns it was going to make.
Right.
In it, because your reality is in a blurred place throughout the film.
Yes, right. So. Yeah. And you try to keep, even if it's shots that are later in the movie, you want to keep it from spoiling. And, there are people who go frame by frame. And sometimes if you go frame by frame, you can figure it out. I remember I did the Scream 4 trailer and a friend of mine went frame by frame. And then they wrote to me and said, this is the ending. I was like, I can't say, but.
Oh,
they were right from one shot in that movie.
Why would they want to know that? Why would they want that justification? I mean,
I don't understand. But this is somebody who used to read like Wikipedia, breakdowns of movies, before they'd see. I'm like, huh.
And so Ryan, fun. I bet you don't miss those days where it's like a trailer would debut, and then when we were in the web world, it's like here's 175 screen grabs from the trailer you just watched.
Right? That's not how I cut. Like, I mean, well, honestly, actually, that Cabin in the Woods piece, there was a thought process behind that, like, people are going to screen grab this and be like, and then be like, why are those strangers' masks in there? Like, why is there computers in a cabin in the woods? What the hell is going on? So,
what's the most out there trailer you've gotten away with where you just like, I thought those pretty bonkers and I went with it?
That's one of them. That's why I sent it to you. I think 10 Cloverfield Lane was a pretty interesting trailer.
Twist. Yeah, I like it.
And that trailer is just, it's pretty much, there's no dialogue, mm-hmm. is there? Or maybe it's like, there's like John Goodman just yelling, but it's just a song that we establish visually and then we slow it down. Mm-hmm. And make it seem like something's wrong. And then that trailer benefited from having just a great pedigree. I mean, J.J. Abrams, just doing, like, if I had done that trailer and we didn't have a card that said J.J. Abrams, I don't know if a studio would have had, mm-hmm. The guts to do it. They might have, but then after J.J. Abrams, then we brought up Cloverfield.
Yeah.
And then we said 10 Cloverfield Lane. And it's like, that sells it. And that's a great example of taking a risk and, the studio having confidence, because that's not a normal trailer.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that besides TV spots, et cetera, that I believe was put out, theatrically, which is kind of a big deal. Mm.
Interesting.
I was going to ask what some of your favorite trailers are,
right.
either growing up or recent, because obviously Elric just mentioned the Suspiria one.
Yes.
I will always have a soft spot for Leatherface Texas Chainsaw Massacre
3. I totally agree. That's amazing. Yeah.
The Lady of the Lake throws the chainsaw.
So good. Yeah.
It's like the movie wasn't even shot yet, but they had that.
Right. I'm kind of standard for a horror, like a generic horror fan, liking Alien. The Alien teaser is just freaking crazy. That music, they brought it back for Prometheus, that sound. Again, that's like using sound design way early. Also, The Shining is amazing. Yes. But I think one of my favorites is the unreleased trailer for The Exorcist.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever see that one with the that like black and white shots?
And it's got the original Lalo Schifrin score.
Yeah, yeah, that's just horrifying. And it... And it's great. I actually really like the teaser for Exorcist 2 as well, The Heretic, with that bonkers Ennio Morricone score.
Yeah.
I've tried and I have never presented because they would kill me. But sometimes I just, if I have a little extra time, I'm like, I'll try my way out there idea. And I've tried to cut to that song. I tried to cut a Green Inferno trailer, not the one that was released, but one of my options that I gave to the studio. I cut a Green Inferno trailer to the score from Sorcerer. Again, like I got inspired, and I did it without any dialogue. Yeah. I just did it as a visual. I thought it was really cool.
You ever hear how Friedkin discovered that band?
I've heard about
how he just was driven out into the middle of the German jungle into darkness, and then music just plays all around. No one had heard of them at that point, and he's like, "Yes, we're going to take that score and score the movie live. Yeah. Like we're going to play the music while we're filming the trucks." And I was just like, "That is amazing," because it's a similar thing that what you're doing. You know, it's a similar kind of art form. You have to be able to see it. You know?
I was going to say that's a funny thing. I bought the Sorcerer's score on vinyl. Mm-hmm. I found it recently at a record shop, and on the back is a freaking quote saying, "If I had discovered Tangerine Dream sooner, I would have used them for The Exorcist."
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, interesting.
Who knows how that would have turned out?
Yeah, well, Tubular Bells is a little Tangerine Dreamy. Yeah, but yeah. I think the rest was, a lot of it is Penderecki, you know, Christoph Penderecki, who is like horror score 101. Especially my early days of horror, I used a lot of Penderecki. And they use a lot of horror filmmakers in their rough cuts will like temp score with Penderecki. It's like half the finish score in The Shining, you know, those high strings and those, you know, and I've used him in Dawn of the Dead and, you know, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill, it's been great having you on, I'm not closing up. I would love to talk to you about what you've won awards for.
Oh, my God.
Ty, come on. Gloat. This is the moment to gloat.
You deserve credit, especially for that list there that a lot of people don't know that
before you came here, Rob showed me your IMDb page.
Oh, I have one credit for a feature, at the Devil's Door, which I'm proud of.
But it's just amazing that like somebody who could literally have hundreds of trailers is recognized.
So impressionable.
I think it's kind of embarrassing. I think IMDb, especially, and it's the same with commercials, right? Mm-hmm. I meet people who have these long commercial directing gigs, and then it's like one IMDb credit. You're like, well, this doesn't seem right.
Right.
Maybe it needs to be an adjustment to how we look at this information. Right.
I've been doing it for a while. Yeah. So, the other thing I wanted to say, when you said about filmmakers using stuff, Mike Doherty, the opening of my trailer, what he put into his movie, the opening of Trick or Treat.
The PSA.
The PSA. That was my idea, and I did it for the trailer, and I love Mike. He's so
awesome.
Yeah. Mike is great.
Haunting in Connecticut, I won something for. Texas Chainsaw, Dawn of the Dead.
Dawn of the Dead's a good one.
You've been to my house. It's like one room where I try to hide a woman in black.
But the great thing is they have these Golden Trailer Awards.
Yeah.
And
the Clio Key Art Awards. There's two different
things. That's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. But what were you going to ask, Rob?
Well, first, Elric, have you seen his Once Upon a Time in Hollywood trailer?
Is it the new one? Because I've seen the new trailer. Okay, yeah, I saw the new trailer, and I was all like, I couldn't be more excited after, because it didn't give away anything that I need to know. I just don't want to know, you know, some of the big twisty. I don't want to know what the Mansons do yet. I you know what I mean. I don't want to know that part of the movie.
Right.
But I was totally in. So
right. Good. Well, I'm glad. I'm really happy with that. With the stuff that we did.
Turned out great.
I wanted to wrap up with how we normally start. It's like, obviously, Bill has such an affinity for horror. So where did it start for you? Like, when did you become such a horror fan?
Since I was little. I guess the first things I can remember really liking, I was really intrigued by horror sound effects records, like the Disney sound, thrilling, chilling sounds of a haunted house. There was another record called Sounds to Make You Shiver, which... I actually tried to use part of that in the Halloween trailer too, underneath when he's walking around the neighborhood, but we didn't license it. But anyway, I was into those horror sound effects records, and so I kind of developed a taste for it. And then I got really intrigued, you know, like Sneak Previews. Mm-hmm. That was the Gene Siskel, Roger Ebert show on PBS when they first reviewed Halloween. Not the one when they talked about Slasher, but I think the first time they reviewed Halloween, I saw that one clip, the closet clip, I was hooked. I was so enamored with that. And then I read the novelization of Halloween, and I became obsessed with that movie, and I finally saw it. And I just, it took off from there. Yeah. And so like horror movies, you know, started then. And then I just worked at a video store on the East Coast, Midwest, and West Coast.
Wow. We are legion. We are all legion.
I know. I started at 15.
Wow.
Imagine renting X-rated videos when you're 15. Yeah. But the bug caught me early for horror stuff. And I've just, you know, I've been a huge fan ever since. And, you know, sometimes people say, you know, even in the industry, you know, there's execs, you know, who respect what I do, but they're like, you know, maybe, you know, wouldn't you love to do, you know, something besides horror? And I'm like, well, I guess for a palate cleanser, but I don't mind you know, doing horror and not, you know, bigger Marvel movies all the time. And, you know, it's fun to do something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood or Wolf of Wall Street, which I did the trailer too on.
Well, that's a great trailer. And that's an incredible movie too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I got lucky that, you know, people take a chance because sometimes, you know, you think the horror ghetto, but I've gotten, you know, really lucky with that. But I love doing it. And it's not, you know, I don't feel ashamed to work on it. You know, there was a time, especially early when I was really cutting a lot of horror trailers, you know, around Texas Chainsaw, they're like, we want to get you out of this. I'm like, no, don't, please. No, this is what I want to do. And I want to work on all of them. And if I don't get the finish, I get sad.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome.
Well, thank you finally for coming on.
Oh, yeah. thank you for having me.
We've been wanting to have this conversation for quite a while. So thanks for
And when I listen to you guys talk about trailers, I'm like, I want to chime in.
Yeah. Get in there.
I wrote to you when you guys talked about the Mother trailer. Remember,
that was the one. Yeah.
I sent you an email. Yeah, and I remember because you were like, the marketing isn't representative. I'm like, I wrote, like, if you watch the movie, then watch the trailer. Yeah. I think we did a damn good job. I love that movie and I love that trailer, and it was a joy. I love that movie as well.
Yeah.
And anyway, this will be fun because we'll share throughout the week after this episode. Yeah. We'll share a bunch of the trailers periodically throughout our social media.
I think with Mother as a film, not the trailer. I knew when it was over that I'd have to wait a few years to watch it again. Like I knew, I don't know how I land. Like I was really interested by it, but it's like, I'm going to wait 5 more years. I'm going to rewatch this movie and see where
The moment I saw it, I was I love
Aronofsky for just swinging so hard.
I think that's
so,
how I feel about Suspiria.
Yeah, no, I agree with Suspiria. Dude, there's certain movies.
I don't need to see Suspiria anytime soon.
It's hard to judge movies when they first come
out. I'm going to watch Suspiria. The next time I watch, I'm going to watch it as a mini series throughout a week. Because it has the 6 chapters.
Right.
And I remember when it got to like, because it tells you it's 6, when it got to 3, I was like, oh.
Whenever they say 3? Chapter 1 on any movie, I'm like, that, it's good. No matter how good the movie is, it's going to like, I think, demarcate
it. So I want to watch it literally, because you know what? We'll close here. I did watch finally the Hateful Eight, the Netflix TV series version, and I thought it was actually pretty great.
Cool. Yeah, it's
4 episodes. It's edited
differently. It's a very episodic movie, so it makes sense.
And there actually is a lot more subtle things, especially in the first 2 episodes, that I understand why they cut it out of the movie, but it feels kind of, you know what that version feels like? It feels like you see a movie and then you go and buy the book. And you get all these little interesting snippets that are like filling in the blanks because now you're reading the book.
Right.
That's what the Netflix version of Hateful Eight feels like. Where, like you're getting the whole novel.
How long are the segments? 30 minutes?
It's an hour long each. They're like 50 minutes.
And there's about 20 something minutes of stuff no one's seen.
Yeah,
spread out.
It's re-edited. It's slightly different.
How did I not know that?
And Tarantino is the one who made it. It's not like Netflix dictated to him.
They kind of dropped it and everyone's like, oh, they just cut the movie in 4. And then he had to like clarify. He's like, no, I re-edited the movie for Netflix. This is my miniseries novel version of it.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's when it changed. Most important question of all, and only you can answer this for me. This is just for me, not for the rest of
you. Okay, Ryan and I will leave.
Do I watch the It 2 trailer?
Yeah, I think so. Okay, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
I consider that a teaser.
Okay, I'm going to do it.
You know, whether or not they release anything else, I don't know. But, you know, I think.
So just give me a feel. It's not.
Yeah, I mean, it's a scene.
Yeah.
It's a scene and a montage.
Okay.
It's a full scene, kind of like The Conjuring was.
And then I'm going to write it.
We'll have Elric's thoughts on that teaser
next week.
And I'll yell from my car, hey!
You'll write me another letter.
Thanks for coming on, Bill.
Thank you.
That was really great. Thanks.
Thanks.